From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Joining me on the program are John Tanza, managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus radio program, and Mitch Biter. He's a production assistant with VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit, working on PCUSA, Encounter, and Issues in the News. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Zach Verton. He's the author of a new book, A Rope from the Sky, The Making and Unmaking of the World's Newest State. It details the gradual rise and collapse, hopefully temporary, of the nation of South Sudan. Mr. Verton's book details South Sudan's history through firsthand accounts, from its struggle for independence from Sudan, which was achieved in 2011 to great fanfare and through strong U.S. support, to its descent into chaos, corruption, and civil war by the summer of 2013. However, soon after independence, South Sudan, dominated by the ethnic groups Dinka and Nuer and led by the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, suffered the so-called resource curse of many oil-rich African countries and descended quickly into corruption and poor nation-building strategies. In retrospect, it seemed painfully evident that the deck was stacked against the new republic. Zach Verton previously served in the Obama administration as an advisor to the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. He also was a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. Currently, he's a lecturer of public and international affairs at Princeton University and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution's Doha Center. We'll be talking with Zach Verton about his new book, what he saw on the ground, why the situation played out the way it did, and prospects for peace and reconciliation given the signing of a new peace agreement in September 2018. And Zach Verton joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Carol.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues, John Tanza. He's managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus.
I'm glad to be here, Carol.
And Mitch Biter, he's working with us temporarily as a production assistant.
Thanks for having me on, Carol.
Well, Zach Verton, congratulations on your book.
Thanks so much.
Tell us what prompted you to write it, and particularly what's behind the title.
Yeah, so A Rope from the Sky. In the Nilotic folktales of South Sudan, the earth and the sky were once linked by a rope, and that meant that the South Sudanese people could travel up and down that rope, and they had access to the gods and to the heavens and to eternal life. But sadly, that rope was severed on account of human error, and it meant that the people were forever resigned to the difficulty and suffering and mortality that is the human condition. And sadly, in some ways, this is a story of paradise lost. So I think Sudan is a place that registers widely in popular consciousness. People know about Darfur and the popular campaign to stop the war there, or they know about the Lost Boys who settled in villages and cities all across the United States and Canada. But most people don't know this really extraordinary story of how Africa's largest state was split in two, how the South Sudanese fought in this righteous liberation struggle, how they achieved independence, how Barack Obama proclared in July of 2011 that the map of the world had been redrawn, and sadly, how it all came undone just 2 years later. So for me, this is first a South Sudanese story, I hope, told through many of its characters about liberation and survival and hopefully about redemption, as you mentioned. But it's also a story about the United States and about American foreign policy at both its best and at its worst. And I think people also don't know this extraordinary coalition from right and left that came together over the course of three different presidential administrations to try to aid the South Sudanese in this cause.
Quick follow-up. In terms of independence, people have questioned whether or not it was really a good idea, given what has happened to date. But you conclude in your book that independence was not inherently a mistake, rather that the territory's leaders and their international backers perhaps did too little to prepare the political, social, and economic foundations for a viable state. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, that's right. So when the sort of good news story in South Sudan gave way to this conscience shock and violence in 2013, there were immediately fingers pointed and sort of gotcha accounts saying, well, look, United States and these other supporters, this was a huge mistake. And I think that was wrong. And I think it failed to understand both the context and the likely alternatives to separation in 2011. So the context is that had the South Sudanese been denied this opportunity for political self-determination after generations of struggle, I think a new and larger war may well have ensued between the North and South in a war that could well have engulfed the whole region. And secondly, if you look at South Sudan, this was the most deliberately underdeveloped place on earth. No roads, no schools, no services, no voice in their own government. South Sudanese had long been second-class citizens, really. And so I think the opportunity to exercise self-determination was justified, and the international support for that was justified. So I don't think independence was a mistake. I think the more pertinent critiques, these are the critiques that I try to unpack in the book, are those of expectations and of execution. And as you say, I think the more worthwhile conversation is whether the political and social and economic foundations were put in place for a viable state to succeed in South Sudan.
Well, I think our colleague John Tanza may have some insights there and may want to follow up on that matter.
Yeah,
John.
Sure. I would like to just follow up on the expectations, because the right after independence, it was widely known that South Sudan was the making of the United States. In fact, most people would say the United States midwifed South Sudan.
That's right.
And when the country plunged into crisis, what a lot of analysts called it at that time, the mute response from the United States was a bit surprising. Was there any reason why the United States did not stop the war?
I think that's an outsized expectation that the United States, whether in South Sudan or any other place, can simply come in and stop a war. You know, one part of this book is political autopsy. And I do think that that means we need to go back and look at both the role of the West, but also the role of the leading party in South Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. And so I try to do that in this book. And I don't think an appropriate political autopsy begins in 2013, when the violence begins. I think we need to go back not even to Independence Day or even to the end of Sudan's long civil war that ended in 2005. I think we need to go back further and really look at the nature of the movement itself that was fighting in South Sudan and to the relationship that was built with the United States. So I preview this in the book. I think the ethos of the movement that Dr. John Garang built was deeply undemocratic, and this was something that was largely unseen to foreigners and to supporters both in the United States and elsewhere in Europe and in the region. I think it lacked a meaningful connection with average South Sudanese people. This became an elite class of political leaders in South Sudan that over time become increasingly accountable not to their people, but to a constituency of foreigners too willing to back them at any price. And I think lastly, there's this party factionalism. So as we know, when Dr. John Garang, in some ways one of the fathers of South Sudan, dies tragically in a helicopter crash at this really existential moment for South Sudan, there's little that's left in his wake. And these elite factions within his party fight for control, right? And so there's a vacuum. And rather than having all these guys developing a new platform and new ideas and a new political program for the future of South Sudan, instead, they're engaged in a really vicious behind-the-scenes battle for control of the party.
Your book captured the situation after the death of Garang very, very, very well. And you mentioned that deficit in leadership when Garang died.
What year was that again he died?
He died in 2005, July, to be precise, at the end of July. Now, when you started chapter 12 with a very interesting quote that we made Italy, now we need to make Italians. And you went on to argue that South Sudanese got independence, but they failed to get the nation. Talk in that effect a little bit.
Sure. I think very often in this day and age, whether in South Sudan or other places around the world, we focus on the question of state building. And that's critically important, building the mechanisms and the institutions of a functioning state. But we focus too little, I think, on building a nation. So the sort of glue that had held South Sudanese constituencies together during their long struggle was a collective opposition to the North, was a collective opposition to repressive governments in the capital in the North, in Khartoum. And that kept the people together behind this common goal. But once that was achieved, really the bottom fell out. And the cracks that had long existed within South Sudanese society are then exposed. And as I said, rather than develop a new plan, a new political program, new ideas about what would bind South Sudanese together, these political elites sadly engage in a power struggle that really rips the social fabric of South Sudanese society, which was so delicate and was just beginning to heal.
You talk about these elites so much in your book. Garang was a leader of what is now the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. And most of the people who are leading this country today, the South Sudan, people who were with Garang. What went wrong? Why did Garang's ideology not continue in what is now South Sudan?
I think in part this is due to the ethos of the movement. So perhaps overlearning the lessons of liberation movements past, Dr. John Garang was very worried about the cracks emerging within South Sudanese society. And so his answer was to grip that movement very tightly. And so all of the leadership decisions, all of the direction of the movement wasn't happening by committee. It wasn't happening through building up democratic structures. It really was happening through him and him alone. And so as some White House officials at the time comment during the Bush administration, when he dies, there's nothing left. And the United States in particular didn't have relationships with others that could carry that cause forward.
And just the current relationship, or rather the relationship between the South Sudan government and the United States, has been shaky right from the time of former President Barack Obama to this current administration. Why did the U.S. fail out with the government in Juba?
A good portion of this book tries to take a deep look at the role of the United States. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I don't think we're particularly good at lessons learned. I think we're particularly bad when it comes to Africa. We don't take it as seriously as some other regions of the world. And yet, as we look about our own posture and our own relationships in Yemen or in Syria or in Afghanistan or the next crisis, I do think there are some lessons learned that we should be examining more closely in South Sudan. So there's an epigraph that opens chapter 22 of the book, which is called Love Lost. And this is really, as you allude, about the relationship between the United States and South Sudan, which sours over time. And I sat down with one of America's foremost champions of the SPLM and asked him about this. And he said, you know, you can become very close to someone, but still be a tough friend. And we were never a tough friend. And for me, that kind of sums up the relationship. So it's really important to note that there wouldn't be a South Sudan today if it weren't for the United States. And the role of the U.S. was critical throughout, providing food aid during the South's long liberation struggle, helping to end a war in 2005 that the South Sudanese couldn't end on their own, and ultimately guaranteeing that right to self-determination. But having adopted the underdog's cause and leaned on the scales and, in my opinion, moved on too soon, I think the role of the West warrants critical reflections. So I think in many ways, once this was achieved and there was this euphoric high in 2011, many in the West and in Washington and elsewhere mistook Independence Day as the finish line of the South Sudanese project rather than the starting block. This was absolutely a righteous cause, but as I've alluded, because of that, because of the way the relationship was built, over time, I argue that America's posture skews too far from a balanced center. And it had consequences in South Sudan. So there's a simplified narrative about the war. There's an unqualified belief in the righteousness of the cause. And there's a compulsion to act. And this ultimately warps the political space, both in Washington, but also in South Sudan. And in some ways, I think, blinded foreign supporters to the flaws of their chosen heroes.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Mr. Zach Verton. He's the author of the new book about South Sudan, A Rope from the Sky, The Making and Unmaking of the World's Newest State. I'm Carol Castiel, along with John Tanza. He's managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus, and Mitch Biter. He's production assistant in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Now here's a shout out to a loyal Twitter follower from South Sudan, John Malok Machual. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to Zach Verton, author of A Rope from the Sky. Zach, let's go back in history a bit and talk about this unusual coalition in the United States, in particular from the right and the left, religious groups, probably because of the Christian character of South Sudan. There were both pros and cons about this, but talk about why this coalition was so critical in helping to, in a sense, give birth to this new country.
Dr. John Garang has helped begin this liberation movement in the early 1980s in South Sudan, and they're allied with the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War. But when the Cold War ends, John Garang finds himself on the wrong side of history, and he says, I've got to go to the United States. And John Garang had undertaken education in Iowa and military training in Georgia, and so he had this cultural curriculum. He understood the United States and how to speak to people. And so he comes to the United States, and he develops this very diverse coalition. He goes to Capitol Hill and he sells slavery and racism to Democrats on the left in the Congressional Black Caucus. He talks about religious persecution with Republicans and Christians from the Bible Belt. Ultimately, this coalition includes human rights groups on the Hollywood left, and it's a really remarkable coalition across the aisle, and that includes three U.S. administrations. There's an interesting story in the book where John Garang is in Texas and he's visiting the church of George W. Bush and his family in Midland, Texas. Two churches that morning. One church is conservative, the other liberal, and the story goes that Dr. John Garang, speeding between the two church services to give sermons, is rewriting and tailoring the Bible verses to match the coalition. So he really understood the United States, and he builds this incredible coalition. But, as I argue in the book, interestingly, I think South Sudan and this support for the United States comes at a kind of unique nexus between the humanitarian, values-based foreign policy of the United States and, in some ways, a near total lack of national security interest. And so it was a righteous cause. There was reason to support it. But I think the policy is shaped in a way that it wouldn't have happened, as I've alluded, in other places, had this been China or Russia or Iran or, quote-unquote, more serious regions of the world. And so, as a result, we get a policy begun over time that's shaped by a handful of individuals. And as I've alluded to, over time, I argue that leads us down a dangerous road where we would become too close to the SPLM, become blinded to the flaws of these chosen heroes. And in some ways, these liberation fighters in South Sudan are given white hats. The narrative is that this is big, bad Islamist government in the north against nice, young, black Christians in the south. And the reality is that the situation was far more complicated than that. But we gave white hats to our chosen partners in South Sudan, and they become whiter over time. And ultimately, I think we lose sight of the goals for which they had articulated.
And as you said, the fact that independence occurred should have been seen as the first step, not the culmination of a dream. So let's take a look forward to 2013. What are the factors that set off this firestorm that led to chaos, particularly between Salva Kiir, the leader, and Riek Machar from the Nuer ethnic group? To what extent is this a power struggle, and to what extent is it an ethnic conflict or some combination thereof?
I think that's a really critical question in understanding South Sudan, both past and present. And there were deep ethnic divides in South Sudan. What most people don't know is that actually during the war between Sudan's north and the south, more southerners died in that war fighting against each other. There were these deep ethnic rifts in South Sudan over the course of a generation. But in 2011, this military movement steps into the role of governors. And they struggled, like many others have, to make that transition. And at that time, Riek Machar and several others in the party argue that it's time for change. There's time for renewal. But this is first and foremost a power struggle, as I've mentioned, between the elites of the party. And when that power struggle breaks down, when political competition breaks down, there aren't the institutions in place to absorb this. And so that fight turns ugly. And these leaders of the SPLM sort of summon the ghosts of a really difficult ethnic past. The social fabric of South Sudan is just beginning to heal. And to achieve their own political ends, these men rip that fabric again. And the war, which begins as a political feud, quickly turns ethnic. So when the war begins, there's a narrative that this is about Dinka and Nuer, and it ultimately becomes a deeply ethnic and deeply polarized war. But it doesn't start that way. It starts as a feud between South Sudan's political elites.
Indeed, you're right, Zach, that this 2013 conflict can only be understood from the past history. I mean, this goes back to the 1991 Nasser Declaration, when Dr. Lamar Kall and Riek Machar declared a coup against Dr. John Garang. And there was fighting in Bor, and a lot of people were killed. And so in 2013, the rift in the ruling party, the SPLM, President Kiir actually reminded people by saying that we won't allow the repeat of 1991 to take place. And that's what really triggered the ethnic divide. President Kiir's, you know, most of the soldiers who are from his community started hunting people from Machar's community. That was clearly captured in your book.
That's absolutely right. Again, I think there was a more nuanced power struggle that's happening inside the SPLM that does include President Salva Kiir, the man who's been gifted the big black cowboy hat by President George Bush. In some ways, his arch nemesis, the leader of the Nuer community, Riek Machar, in the book, who's called a rebel with a PhD. But there is also several other groups of SPLM leaders who believe themselves to be the rightful heirs of John Garang's movement. And so this is an elite battle. as you say, when things fall apart in 2013, there is this appeal to their ethnic bases. And it's a deeply dangerous, in many ways, irresponsible appeal, given how inflammatory those comments were. So President Kiir alludes to maybe the most painful episode in South Sudan's troubled ethnic past, 1991, which really set off a decade of violence between Dinka and Nuer. And as I've alluded to, was only beginning to heal in 2011. This is a time when South Sudanese, for the first time, are trying to think of themselves not first as Dinka or Nuer or Shilluk, but as a South Sudanese citizen. What does that mean? That is just beginning in 2011 when this elite power struggle really tears the place apart.
So it's a shame that that identity couldn't have been developed more to have averted this rift, which originally began, as you said, as a power struggle, to avoid it descending into this ethnic conflict. But there's also another economic aspect, and that is, of course, the curse of oil, because it's an oil-rich country. And unfortunately, you alluded to the fact that other sectors were not properly developed. I'm assuming we can blame both outside actors, the West, who wanted to shepherd the new country into existence, as well as the internal leaders. How much of a factor does this economic aspect play into the descent into chaos?
It's an absolutely central piece of understanding South Sudan's modern history. First, the reality that many of Sudan's rich oil deposits, by a cruel twist of geological fate, happened to fall right underneath the border between north and south. And so oil politics and a fight over oil really animates much of Sudan's civil war. It is then the centerpiece of a really messy divorce in 2011 and 2012 between north and south, when they're struggling to divide a country when it comes to currency and assets and liabilities and securities. Actually, separating these two states is extraordinarily difficult, and oil is in many ways the centerpiece. But lastly, in terms of South Sudan's own oil and its role in the making of a state, South Sudan at independence in 2011 had two things going for it. It had an extraordinary reservoir of international goodwill, and it had oil reserves that many African states would kill for. And so many saw oil as the economic viability to a state in South Sudan. However, as you allude, and as we've seen sadly in so many other states, they too suffered from the resource curse. And so this oil is captured by the leaders of South Sudan, and really a patronage network is developed. And it is really the grease on the South Sudanese sort of political powertrain. And many will argue that this fateful decision that happened in 2012, when South Sudan decided to shut off its own oil. They were in the middle of very difficult negotiations with the North. The North wanted to take a lot of the South Sudanese oil. They wanted to charge the South Sudanese exorbitant fees to ship that oil to market, and the South Sudanese weren't having of it. And really, this was very much the centerpiece of this divorce, as I mentioned, and almost brought the two sides back to war. South Sudan takes this fateful decision, which I outline in the book, to shut off its own oil as a bargaining chip, and in some ways it backfires. And the grease that had fueled South Sudan's political system in its early years runs dry. And that really exacerbates internal divisions in South Sudan at a time when they can't afford any.
Yeah, and I will just add that the proceeds from this oil, the leaders in the country have nothing to show for the proceeds from this oil, because all the money has been siphoned somewhere. The ordinary South Sudanese have nothing to be proud of. And the other thing is, most of the agricultural belt in South Sudan is a very rich country in terms of the natural resources. The whole of the western part of South Sudan is a farming community. And this community have not been empowered. No agricultural schemes there. And so the dependence on oil became a reality and a curse and a reason for the power struggle.
Absolutely. The true economic viability of South Sudan in the long term is farming. It is agriculture. They did have oil deposits, but what most people don't know, and what many South Sudanese deny to this day, is the reality that oil deposits in South Sudan are fast on the decline, and they have been for more than a decade. And so this switch to agriculture is really the absolute centerpiece of its viability going forward. As we know, both from South Sudan's history and many like it, when fat oil paychecks are rolling in, that has a way of disincentivizing new initiatives like agriculture.
Let me turn now to Mitch for a quick question in that regard.
Yeah, Zach, just wanted to ask you what the country's current relationship is with Khartoum, and what do you think would change if the Sudanese president Omar al-Bashir, who's facing a mounting revolt in this country, has to step down? I know Sudan's had a history in this regard of peaceful overthrows of government in 64 and 85.
So the role of the region, Sudan and other immediate regional countries, is critical here. Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, and Sudan. Countries that all were involved in Sudan's long civil war and have since been involved in the multiple efforts to make peace. So I am skeptical about the viability of this agreement being a truly transformational document in South Sudan, and that is in part because it was always going to need strong regional support and strong regional engagement. When things broke down in 2013, much of the region was exhausted, was fatigued with this, and soon became consumed with their own domestic situations, both in Ethiopia and more recently, as you allude to, in Sudan. So Sudan and Uganda stepped up and have asserted a greater role, something that worries some South Sudanese and other players, given this sort of very strange and complicated history between North and South Sudan. I don't know whether the political tumult in Sudan today will have an immediate impact on South Sudan. Certainly it could, because of oil revenues and because of spillover and because of Sudan's role in the current agreement. But whether or not Omar Bashir goes is today still an open question.
And what is, briefly, Sudan's role in this current agreement?
So both Sudan and Uganda sort of took the lead in the revitalized phase of trying to salvage this regional peace agreement and have asserted themselves as sort of guarantors. And that, in some ways, was welcomed in the near term. It really caused concern among many.
And of course, we're talking about this agreement, and I'm assuming we're referring to the September 2018 peace agreement.
Right. So there's a peace agreement signed in August of 2015, this attempt to try and remake South Sudan, to try and recapture the shards of a shattered dream and hopefully correct course. By the end of that process, we were worried that the kind of transformational economic and security and justice reforms necessary to put South Sudan on a viable path to a new state were weeded out of that agreement. And it was ultimately narrowed to the guys with guns, rather than genuinely including women or other political parties or youth or these many other voices that had been excluded in South Sudanese society. Sadly, that agreement was narrowed again to the factions of the SPLM. So there was concern from the outset. That agreement fell apart shortly thereafter. And it's one of the reasons I have skepticism about the current revitalized agreement, for the same reasons. It's many of the same characters that have been animating South Sudanese politics for too long. I'll just add one point here, and that is I'm often asked about what's needed in the near term to correct course in South Sudan. And I'm encouraged to hear that the violence has been reduced. We need to continue doing things in the short term to assure there's humanitarian assistance to try and put this agreement on the path to success. But really, in my view, this is a long-term prospect. And the larger question here is generational change. I think that is ultimately the most important agreement to South Sudan's future prosperity, is that this class of leaders who have too long animated the political space move on and are replaced by younger people.
And do you see that coming to the fore? Do you see a new generation?
Well, I have optimism, and the last chapter of this book is about a young man named Kong, who I go up and visit, who I met on my first trip to South Sudan and who I went back and visited for this book. And he really is a remarkable young person, and there are many like him across South Sudan. Interestingly, this young man grew up in a refugee camp in neighboring Kenya, and that meant that there was a silver lining, and that was that he received an education that he would not otherwise have received in South Sudan, and he grew up alongside young boys and girls from other ethnic communities in South Sudan. They weren't as isolated. And so they've come back with education and skills and a different vantage point about the future of their country, and that is the reason that I have hope, but it's going to take time. And again, this is, I think, a more important point generally about South Sudan. I think we had some unrealistic expectations. Yes, they had 50 years of experience since their peers in the region became independent. Yes, they had the advancement of global norms, but expecting that they were going to sort of leapfrog the violence and tumult that characterized, you know, the formation of states all across the world, I think that was probably unrealistic. And in that, given this special relationship between South Sudan and the United States, I often, for my own sake, and as we think about this, I try to think about the American Civil War. It wasn't ultimately that long ago that this country fought a vicious war to the tune of 750,000 deaths over economy and identity and the nature of the state. And I think in some ways that is what South Sudan has been going through. So I am optimistic, but I'm optimistic in the long run.
The book is A Rope from the Sky, The Making and Unmaking of the World's Newest State, South Sudan. And the author, Zach Verton. Well, Zach, thanks for coming in and sharing your time and insights about your new book on South Sudan.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Joining me on the program were managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus, John Tanza, and production assistant Mitch Biter. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.